This is David Birdsall of the Mark School of Public and International Affairs. And the first thing I do in the morning is turn on LI News Radio and listen to LI in the AM with Jay Oliver.
And that's a very good advice from the man himself, Dr. David Birdsall, Mark's dean of the Austin W. Mark School of Public and International Affairs, talking about Baruch College, the aforementioned doctor. Sir, how are you? Hope everything is well.
Everything is well here. Great to be with you this morning.
Always great to have you. You know, this is a huge day, and obviously the House, David, set to vote today to impeach this president now for the first time that's ever been done in the history of the country. Single article of impeachment will charge Donald Trump with incitement of insurrection following last week's Capitol breach. And with the House's Democratic majority and the votes of at least five Republican members, led by number three in charge, and that being Liz Cheney, obviously the daughter of Dick Cheney, former VP, who will join the impeachment effort. You know, you're getting the feel the measure will pass, and it'll be the first time ever, as mentioned, that to be impeached twice. You saw, really to me, a big story here is that of Mitch McConnell. Reports are he is very angry with his president. But that doesn't mean he will go along with some of these Republicans. In essence, what happens today as far as McConnell? You know, McConnell's one of those guys, he says a lot of things, some of it in code. You don't really get a feel directly as far as what he is saying. And that'll be the big thing. Which way will Mitch McConnell go as far as a vote today?
Well, that is an excellent question. He has said that the Senate cannot take up this matter until the 19th. There are provisions in Senate procedure that have the Senate barred from making substantive decisions on matters of policy during this break period, barring a vote, and this is in the leader's own version of the rule, barring the affirmative vote of all 100 senators to return to consider, in this case, an impeachment action. Otherwise, this has to wait until literally the day before the inauguration, and it's highly unlikely that you could orchestrate a trial in the Senate, assuming, and I think you're exactly right, that there will be an impeachment of the House no later than midnight tonight. You wouldn't necessarily be able to get it done before Joe Biden becomes president on the 20th. And that leaves us in uncharted territory about what kinds of actions the Congress might choose to take, what kinds of restrictions on the president's future political activity they may move to consider. The leader, as you say, has been speaking in code. There are those who say that he is privately in favor of impeachment, or at least believes that the president has committed impeachable offenses. Whether that means he will vote for conviction or not is an open question. Whether he will call the Senate back into session is an open question. And whether he will simply do nothing and not whip the vote, not insist that the Republican Party fall into line. And, of course, his great strength as a leader has been keeping his caucus more or less in check throughout his entire time in the role. And if he steps out of that role and says, basically, folks, it's up to you, vote your conscience, that itself would be unprecedented during his leadership and a clear indication of the loss of control on the part of Donald Trump. Of the Republican Party and the Republican brand, at least among elected officials, if not among Trump voters.
You know, David, I think a lot of people are kind of torn here. And, you know, and I've been a little bit back and forth in my own mind whether it's the right thing to do, considering the times we're in, considering the division we have, considering the fact you got a new administration coming into play in 7 days. What do you do with Donald Trump? Do you impeach him? Do you throw him out of office? Do you fan the flames even more? Do you create more of a division, or do you move on, take the high road? I'd like to hear something definitive from Joe Biden. I don't think you're going to get that. He's going to pretty much say, let the powers that be kind of handle it, which is not what I want to hear from a new president coming into play. But then I also know and feel that getting rid of this guy will almost get rid of a cancer. Because the Republican Party right now, in my estimation, is at an all-time low. And if you do get rid of this guy, you have the stench and everything else just left around. You have to rebuild bottom up. You know, we talk about bail reform and everything else. Not a tweak or a twang here is going to fix it. It's a complete peel down and then building it back up, which never happened. But that's a whole other story, a little correlation. Here, I do believe that this party needs to be rebuilt from the bottom up, and that means planting new seeds. It's just not going to work any other way. And if they don't feel that way, this party will never get back to form. And, you know, you talk about what happens in 4 years, you know, that's troubling if you are on the GOP side. So, in essence, you know, there is a lot of thinking to be done here, I think, on many, many mindsets on this very important day in history.
This is such a knotty series of problems. On the one hand, I think it's absolutely right. We've got absolutely crushing needs in this country, primarily around the pandemic, secondarily around the economic chaos that it has created. We know that our security systems have been breached by Russia within the course of the last year, and for a period of at least 9 months, that Russian moles were able to delve into our networks and government and private industry, and we don't yet have an adequate defense, even to the point that we know the extent of that intrusion. There is so much that needs to be done, and right now the government is quite plausibly rudderless, not really in a position to respond forcefully to any of these questions. Just take one terrifying example that yesterday was the all-time peak in fatality from coronavirus at 4,400 lost Americans during a single 24-hour period. We desperately need to focus on these matters of substance. And yet, do we allow a president to so flagrantly violate the law, so flagrantly toss aside his constitutional responsibilities, to invite hundreds, maybe thousands of people into the grounds of the Capitol itself to commit what many believe to be sedition, which is certainly violence, vandalism, and aggressive action resulting in the deaths of five individuals? Doesn't there need to be some accountability for that? And do we, in effect, encourage further action of that sort by not making people accountable? And of course, right now, there's a dragnet underway nationwide to arrest some of those hundreds or thousands of people and hold them accountable for their individual actions. But what about their president and the person in whose name they committed these atrocities? These are real questions that I don't have any good answers for. There's going to be a balance. But trying to strike the way forward is really the major question under the rule of law, with the Constitution held aloft as the guiding document, and our understanding of our need to move forward as a more united nation than very clearly we are right now. And I couldn't agree with you more that the Republican Party is in dire circumstances. You essentially have at least three parties right now, the old corporatist business Republican Party of the late 20th century that came out in force, led by New York's own Kathy Wilde, to denounce the president's efforts to overturn the election. This started well before January 6th, with the wholesale withdrawal of corporate support, financial sector support, et cetera. And now that's simply intensified since last week's disturbances. You have a party that is the old Republican hardline defense party. Think of this as the sort of neocon war hawk group typified by Liz Cheney's father, Dick Cheney, former vice president and architect of the Bush administration foreign policy in many ways, together with Donald Rumsfeld and others. And then you have a third portion of the Republican Party that is basically an anti-government party that rejects efforts on the part of government to do almost anything that we typically think of government as responsible for achieving, including things like pandemic responses, including taxation, including many domestic aspects of preparation for national security. And that's the group that you saw rioting last week. One of the major questions for Republicans is, can they win without that bloc? That's one of the reasons that you have found members of Congress so subservient to the president's agenda. Their conclusion since 2016 has been, no, you can't. And so they have sacrificed principle to make sure that they can keep those votes in their column. And is that bloc, or is a significant portion of that bloc, persuadable to return to constitutional order? in service of a set of ideals that would be in conflict, certainly with what the Democrats represent, but consistent with the centuries-long values that we have expressed in terms of the processes of government in the United States.
Good points, no question. David Birdsell with us. Let's move on to another topic. We brought it up briefly, which is the vaccination rollout. It's a disaster. I kind of went off on it for a couple of minutes earlier this morning. Both parties dropping the ball, meaning states and federal government, the way you look at it. You know, it just seems like there are other areas of more importance as far as the administration is concerned. Obviously, the eye has been taken off the prize, and I get Operation Warp Speed, you know, marvelously done, but the, you know, it's great to have product, but if you don't have the execution, distribution, a plan of some sort, then it doesn't mean anything. I mean, you can have the vax, you can have the medicine. If it doesn't get your system, what good is it, right? So, in essence, they've dropped the ball. You have Alex Azar finally coming out and saying, David, you know what? We got to speed it up a little bit. Going to implement a couple of strategies, two of them. You know, see, that doesn't cut it to me. And certainly what the state has done, especially in New York, has been an absolute disaster. Governor seems to be more bent on fining, pointing fingers, threatening, rather than executing the plan. And finally, you know, he comes out with the epiphany during the State of the State. You know, we can't afford lockdowns anymore. We got to get this vaccine going. We just can't afford it from an economic sense. So I look at so many areas of fumbling and bumbling here. And let's face it. Let's be honest here. We are stressing out over this. The elderly are not getting their shots. I have reports coming into me that it's taking months to make an appointment, to get on a website. It's taking a long time. You can't even call. It hangs up on you after an hour and a half. I mean, it's just an absolute, it reminds me a little bit of the stimulus program, first go around trying to, you know, get a hold of the IRS. You look on the website, you can't even find anything. It crashed, you know, the same thing here. You know, it's unbelievable. It's outrageous to me that we cannot get this right. And we don't even have enough testing sites. Now you got rapid sites popping up. It's almost like we are on the fly going along with it and trying to make the corrections when they should have really been put in place, especially in my opinion, when it comes to New York State. Vehemently dropping the ball, David.
There's absolutely no question about it. And it's not as if this is a series of unanticipated problems. All of these problems were amply foreseen and described in great detail by logistical, public health, and systems operations experts for months and months. You didn't need to have a vaccine done to figure out how you need to distribute it once it's ready. This should have been planning that we had sewn up and tied in a bow by the summertime. Now, it's true that we might not have known about all of the refrigeration requirements and what the precise shelf life of the vaccine would be. But we knew early on, based on the research going on at Pfizer and the Oxford AstraZeneca group and others, that it was highly likely that these were going to have to be kept, these vaccines, at very low temperatures. So that makes a huge problem in distribution, right? You've got to figure out how to keep things not just chilly, but super cold, while you're transporting them over large distances to thousands and thousands of locations across the country. You know that it's going to have a short shelf life. Summer of 2020, you may not know exactly how short, but you know you've got to get it into arms fast. So this is an operation at the federal level that should have been clear, that should have been well thought through, that should have been ready to go months before the first person was rolling up her sleeves, ready to take a shot. And then at the state level, that becomes a significant complication, A, because the federal government abdicated that responsibility, leaving it to the states, and then B, the states have neither the money nor necessarily the expertise to begin rolling it out. And you're exactly right that the governor's emphasis on punishment for misdistribution. Now, on the one hand, we want to be clear that there needs to be a pecking order and a scarce resource, and you want to vaccinate those people who are most at risk by whatever standards. But by threatening hospitals and individual healthcare workers with fines for vaccinating the wrong people, there is no surer way to bottle up a distribution chain And when you have the clock ticking on the viability of those vaccines sitting in the refrigerator, that's not a strategy that is guaranteed to get the most vaccine distributed as rapidly as humanly possible.
It's just unforgivable. You know, when I read that New York, the state, is only vaccinating, and I don't want to hear about how the federal government is, you know, it seems like Governor Cuomo is putting the onus here on the federal government. It's not the federal government. It's the state, too. That's why I say both and vehemently drop the ball here. But when I read only 41% of the supply, okay, if you have supply and you're inoculating 41%, well, guess what? Okay, you got no plan. And that's my biggest beef here as far as how the state is going about its business. They have the supply, but it's less than half of inoculation they're using, which is unforgivable to me at this point in time. You know, I mean, it's unreal. You can't blame it at all. It's always the federal government at fault, always pointing a finger. And listen, I get it. Trump's not a lousy judge. He lost the election because of COVID. I understand that. But right now, when you have supply and you're only going 41%, that's unacceptable.
No, you're absolutely right. And both things are true. The federal government should have done a much better job and should have tried to take this right to the doorstep out of the gate. They didn't. That meant it became a state problem. And now states step up because for better or for worse, you are now responsible for getting this into the arms of your citizens. And that has not happened, not just in New York. In some states, the response is even worse in terms of percentage of vaccine supply used and percentage of population inoculated. But there clearly was a major failure of planning. And we know that some of these planning exercises didn't take place, again, until the vaccine was available. And you know, just returning to what I was talking about a moment ago, that's just dumbfounding to me. You don't know exactly what enemy's coming over the hill, but you can still prepare your fortifications. And we didn't do that. And I think one of the lessons I hope going forward is that we recognize that preparedness for a pandemic is something that we need to have always in our back pocket. That's not something that you ramp up in the face of a crisis. That's something you pull off the shelf when the crisis hits. And in many areas, whether we're thinking about medical supply chain, whether we're thinking about redundancies in staffing, yeah, it might not be absolutely the most economically efficient way to do it. But when that pandemic comes, you're going to be pretty happy about some of those redundancies. We need to change wholesale our thinking about some of the ways that we have tried to craft efficiencies in government to the detriment of effectiveness when it comes to responding to crisis moments.
No question. David Birdsall with us. Speaking of failure, you know, what happened last Wednesday, obviously, it doesn't get much worse than that. And now reading where officials have opened up more than 170 subject files, charging over 70 cases in this investigation into the riots at the Capitol, according to the Justice Department, the U.S. attorney, acting one in Washington, said the scope of the crimes is mind-blowing. Could include charges of sedition, conspiracy, serious crimes that could result in up to 20 years in prison. You know, the big question, you know, I have all the alerts now coming through regarding state capitals being alert of the next 7 days. Obviously, you got inauguration day next Wednesday. David, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I cannot fathom, I don't think any of the experts far higher than me, mindset in this area, can figure out what happened last Wednesday. But, you know, it's almost as if you're led to believe that they were in on this thing. And I even hate to state that on this program because, again, I don't believe in those theories. But how in the heck do you let something of that nature happen last week? And the big question is, what do we see in the next 7 days? What do we see? I mean, I can't even imagine the security in place for Inauguration Day. It's mind-boggling.
It's deeply, deeply concerning. And if you look at some of the very late actions on the part of the president to remove officials from permanent service, and in many cases, people who are in acting appointments, because the president has said himself he prefers acting appointments, Chad Wolf stepping down, the acting head of Homeland Security. You've got command chain problems up and down the organization chart in government right now. There actually was, before this event took place, at least 24 hours before this event took place, a detailed FBI warning from a unit in Virginia, warning of precisely what happened last Wednesday. And there was no response on the part of local law enforcement or the Capitol Police. So there are clearly failures here. I don't know if there are acts of commission in the sense that people were involved actively in plotting to do what happened last Wednesday. But there was very clearly an unwillingness on the part of many levels of government. This was also testified to by the head of the Capitol Police that he was prevented by his senior officials. He has since resigned, but prevented by senior officials from mounting a more robust defense of the Capitol perimeter in advance of Wednesday's melee. That is disturbing, to say the least. Right now, we have the Secret Service in charge of the inaugural security preparations, and we hope for a better outcome, at least in the preparedness of our security officials, than what we saw last week. But very, very concerning, and of course, we multiply that problem across 50 state capitals, where the FBI warns that every single one of them has now been threatened and targeted for action on Inauguration Day. That is terrifying. We haven't seen the scale of disruption in this country since the Civil War, if indeed we saw it then.
Troubling times. One more for you quickly, and it went under the radar, of course, with all the other stuff going on. Not a lot of focus here, but it caught my eye regarding the Supreme Court granting the Trump administration's request to reinstate longstanding restrictions for patients seeking a drug use for abortions, talking about early in pregnancy. And it was the, you know, when you think about it, David, it was the first abortion, I think it was, the first abortion-related case to come before the new Supreme Court Justice, Amy Coney Barrett. And I guess it all but confirms abortion rights activist fears that, you know, she'll be a deciding conservative factor, obviously, in such cases. And of course, the FDA has restrictions requiring an in-person visit with a medical professional to pick up the medication. But that being said, I think it pretty much confirms in many an eye right now, with this new administration coming into play. You know, you talk about, I mean, what was the big question all along thrown to Joe Biden, right? Over the electoral months preceding November 3rd is if he was going to pack the court. He never really gave you an answer. But I think after yesterday and this Supreme Court decision, and especially before the new court justice and Amy Coney Barrett, I think it only confirms the fact that you're going to see some major changes going forward regarding decision-making. What about you?
I think it's pretty clearly the case. And of course, in yesterday's decision, it was a 6-3 vote. So they didn't really even need Justice Barrett. There already had a 5-vote majority for this decision on the court. But this 6-vote supermajority does mean that there is a whole raft of legislative priorities that could be overturned in the court. What my strong expectation would be is that the Biden administration, the president-elect himself, president after next Wednesday, he will not seek, at least early on, to expand the size of the court and to pack it with his own nominees. But if it comes to the point where not only on sort of hot-button social issues such as abortion, which of course speaks profoundly to women's rights and to the rights of individuals to dispose of their bodies as they see fit. So I'm not trying to diminish it by talking about it as a social issue or just the hot button. But if the court's majority begins to act against the fundamental premises of the administrative state that have been in place since the first half of the 20th century, and I'm thinking about the idea of government being able to formulate regulations, to conduct science, to inform the crafting of regulations. We know that at least two members of the court, and I'm thinking of Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, are skeptical that these are constitutionally allowable actions. And these are actions that speak to the core of governance as we have understood it since the New Deal and the 1930s. So if it gets to that stage, Then I think the president will have a question about what he needs to do to be able to get substantive legislation through the courts, or at least not have them subject to court challenges that may make it very, very difficult, not only for Joe Biden, but for anybody who believes that government has a role in formulating and enforcing policy, to act in the best interest of the citizenry.
How about that? Interesting times, interesting topic. We look forward to the next time, sir. David Birdsell. Mark Stanley, the Austin W. Mark School of Public International Affairs. We're at the Great Brew College, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll get more fantastic insight from the good Dr. David Birdsell next time. Sir, stay well, stay healthy, and we'll talk again. Should be an interesting day.
You too, Jay. Thanks for having me.